Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Come Out of Her My People show. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and as you know, this is a show where we talk about all kinds of aspects of what that means. I'm referring to Revelation 18:4 that says, "Come out of her, my people, so that you do not participate in her sins and do not partake of her plagues." Well, as I've said for quite a while, I think the plagues are obvious, and if the sins aren't obvious by now, you're probably listening to the wrong program. But in any case, let's talk a little bit today about some of the words that get misused nowadays, and that's at least a big part of the reason why I think a lot of people have difficulty even beginning to understand what it means to come out and what we need to do about it. So I've got a name for this show. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, but this one I'm going to call Let's Talk Treason, simply because there's a whole lot of people that misuse that word, don't have a clue what it really means, kind of like a fascist has to be, so far as the left is concerned, a white male, not necessarily somebody who's openly advocating actual fascist ideology. The same thing goes for treason. I think a lot of the communists think that treason consists in holding an opinion that causes snowflakes to melt, or perhaps especially voting wrongly. Now, that doesn't mean, committing voting fraud by not being a lawful United States type person or anything else. No, what it means is just voting in some way that they consider to be, well, for a deplorable, for example. That's not only verboten, but there's a lot of folks nowadays that would like to kill people for it. And that takes us back to this idea of treason. Let's talk what treason really is. Now, for this, the first place I would go, of course, is the Constitution, Article 3, Section 3. It says, "Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them," plural. That would be the states. And the Ninth and Tenth Amendments talk about the states or the people, and arguably declaring war or acting in a warlike, in other words, killing people, making war against the people of the states, you might be able to argue, and I'll probably explore that in a minute here, also commits the act of treason. But anyway, the definition says, only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Now, later on, it was codified as U.S. 18 United States Code Section 2381, which says almost the same thing word for word. Treason shall consist only in levying war against the states or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And it notes that such shall suffer, and this is what the Constitution says, Congress will declare the penalty, such shall suffer death or no less than 5 years and $10,000. That was back when 10 grand was real money, of course. And to be incapable, this is interesting, of holding any office under the United States. So that would, if we understood what treason was, at least eliminate a whole lot of potential presidential and congressional critter, now congressional traitor candidates and so forth. You notice I've been using that word lately in the news and other places, Congress traitor, because that's what we have if we actually step back and look at it, people who seem to be at war with and or giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the states and the Constitution and just about everything that once, well, was called truth, justice, and the American way. Let me give you a couple of examples of things that I'll throw out as possible suggestions that might certainly fit this definition of treason, levying war against the states or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. How about bringing in an invading force? Yeah, bringing in an invading force. Well, with that, let me turn briefly to a couple of cases. Now, these are old cases having to do with treason. The first one is called United States versus Freeze. And Justice Chase, long time ago, said in the trial, stating the opinion of the court, the following. If a body of people conspire and meditate an insurrection to resist or oppose the execution of any statute of the United States by force, Okay, so let's understand what he's saying. They conspire, oh, this is back before conspiracy theory was a crime in itself, to commit or meditate an insurrection against the United States using force, he says, but they've only conspired, then they're only guilty of a high misdemeanor. But if they proceed to carry such intention into execution by force, then they're guilty of the treason of levying war. So the difference is not just thinking about planning and intending force, but actually carrying out the intention. And the quantum of force, said Justice Chase, neither lessens nor increases the crime. Doesn't matter how many people. It's altogether immaterial, said the court, whether that force used is sufficient to effectuate the object. In other words, doesn't matter whether they've used enough force to be able to accomplish their evil plan. Any force connected with the intention will constitute the crime of levying war. Now, let's think about that for a second. And I mentioned the idea of bringing in an invading force. Let's suppose, for example, somebody was paying to bring in a huge number of invaders from south of the border. I know that the news will say there are now well over 10,000 people in and heading north through Mexico. The Mexican government has even said they've received over 10,000 requests for visas so that they can come on through and attack the U.S. from the south. Now, they're going to come out and say attack, but they are willing to storm the borders. Does that constitute bringing in an invading force? Well, so far, at least, they haven't actually committed the act of carrying the invasion into execution by force. But admittedly, there's a lot of, lots to slip twixt the cup and the lip here. Let me throw out one more, I'd suggest, a really interesting and certainly possibility we've heard a lot about lately. How about not just the threat, but the execution of an intent to disarm the American people by force? There have been a number already killed. I'm thinking of people in, places like Lavoie-Finicum, just for the act of resisting what Big Brother wanted to do. There was, of course, a case of a guy in Maryland. There are now millions of felons in New Jersey who they're felons, and they are therefore subject to execution by Big Brother and the New Jersey State Police if they decide to go the next step and actually levy war against those people who said, no, you know, the concept of private property ought to have some meaning, especially since shall not be infringed once did as well. So when does a threat to commit force, even if a few people have already been killed, when does it become an actual war? Now, remember one other thing, folks. The threat by the Redcoats to seize the powder and ball, in other words, to come and take the guns and the ammunition of the colonists, were what fomented the first shots fired in the American Revolutionary War. One other comment. Now, this one comes from the United States versus Aaron Burr. Now, you know that was a long time ago. If you haven't been to the public cesspools recently, you probably know who Aaron Burr was. He got into a duel with a guy named Alexander Hamilton, who they've glorified since then because he was a royalist and not really a big fan of the Constitution, although you could argue that what he intended to happen in terms of that document being pretty well overturned is probably well underway. Anyway, Chief Justice Marshall in that case said there's no difficulty in affirming there must be a war when it comes to treason, or else the crime of levying it cannot exist. But there would often be considerable difficulty in affirming, and this is what we're seeing, that a particular act did or did not involve the person committing it in the guilt and in the fact of levying war. That basically describes where we are today with so many people who have threatened war, like that communist traitor from California, Swalwell, that basically says, we intend to disarm the American people, we're going to steal their guns, and we got nukes. That's a threat of war, but he hasn't actually been able to implement it yet. Nevertheless, he has certainly voted, and others have intended to do all kinds of things heading in that general direction. So back to Justice Marshall. If, he said, for example, an army should be actually raised for the avowed purpose of carrying on an open war against the United States, like if thousands upon thousands of people were amassed south of the border and heading north, if people were being disarmed in preparation, there's a little bit of discussion worthy there. Anyway, back to Marshall. For the avowed purpose of carrying an open war against the United States and subverting their government, I could argue the government's already been subverted. You know, there are very few parts of the Constitution that still apply anymore. Well, he says that point must be weighed very deliberately before a judge would venture to decide that an overt act of levying war had not been committed by a commissary of purchases who never saw the army, but knowing its object, allied themselves with the rebels and so forth and so on. In other words, when it comes to actually levying war, the question is, I guess I'll put it this way, how many must die? How many actually have to die before we say, okay, now there is war? I would venture to suggest that there was an act of war committed against an American citizen, high profile, because CNN was there, last week in Florida, when a guy who had committed absolutely no hint of any violent crime and indeed had indicated he would be willing to surrender if they actually tried to do what they intended to do, and he knew about it, and he did, well, they sent more troops against him, highly armed, literally with weapons that the American peons are no longer permitted to have. Could have very well killed him. He had guns pointed at his head when he opened the door. Was that an act of war? Well, I guess not if the intent is to subvert an elected president by the very existence of the witch hunt to begin with. You see what I'm getting at here? This is an interesting situation because we've come so far from the very definitions of what treason once meant and what open war is and what the real government of the United States is, given that we've got people who no longer care about an oath before God, who no longer even put their hands on a Bible, and who no longer honor what it says. In fact, they are enemies domestic of the Constitution. Is that an act of making war? We have states like Maryland, Florida, New Jersey, and certainly California, where so many acts of open war have been committed against the populace that it's no longer possible to even argue that people there have a right to keep and bear arms, to own property, to do anything that free people once had a constitutionally protected right to do. Now, I want to quote a couple of items from a fellow named Madison. James Madison. If you haven't been to public cesspools, you might know the name here too. He said, and I've quoted this many times, when it comes to looking at what's going on, quote, it's proper to take alarm at the first experiment on our liberties. We hold this prudent jealousy to be the first duty of citizens and one of the noblest characteristics of the late revolution. The freemen of America, back when they were free, I note, didn't wait until usurped power had strengthened itself by exercise and entangled the question in precedence. They saw all the consequences in the principle, and they avoided the consequences by denying the principle. We, he said then, revere this lesson too much to forget it. Well, that was a long time ago, folks, and the lesson has been forgotten. The same Madison said, you know what, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of the rights of the people by the gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. He talked frequently about the advantage that Americans have of being armed, which the American people possess over the people of almost every other nation. And basically, the whole point of the Second Amendment was to make sure that what is happening now, a war against the people to do exactly what the colonists fought and died to prevent, was their disarmament, their enslavement, and all the things that go with it. Well, where I want to go next is a really interesting piece that I think will kind of help to outline some of this, and it'll set the stage for after the bottom of the hour. To talk about what do we do about this, and in particular, what kinds of things fit into which categories of something we can do something about. Now, this piece comes from The Burning Platform, and basically it's a comparison of two really great books, both once required reading, at least one or the other in most cases, the famous 1984 by George Orwell, and the other book by Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. And there's a third book here that's being described in the process of this article from the Burning Platform, written decades ago, but ever so prescient. It's called Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business, that was written in the 80s by Neil Postman. Now, this is kind of interesting, and this is where I'll start out. he describes the difference between the visions, the terrifying anti-utopian futures of Huxley and Orwell by saying the following. What Huxley teaches is that in the age of advanced technology, spiritual devastation, I like that term, is more likely to come from an enemy with a smiling face. Now we've got a little happy face, you can put an emoji out there. Then from one whose countenance exudes suspicion and hate. Remember that line about Satan's greatest achievement, convincing people he doesn't exist? Or, maybe even better still, if he does exist, he wears a smiley face, and he's from the government, and he's here to help you. In any case, in the Huxleyan prophecy, says the author, Big Brother does not watch us by his choice. We watch him by ours. There's no need for wardens or gates or ministries of truth. And then he goes on to say the following, speaking for the author. When a population becomes distracted by trivia, now remember, this was written over three decades ago, folks. When a population becomes distracted by trivia, when cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainments, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, now we call it snowflake talk, when, in short, a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. Culture death is a clear possibility. From there, I go to one more quote, this time from the author of the article that's doing the review here of the book and the commentary. He says, when virtually everyone in America has now got access to the internet, smartphones contain more computing power than NASA once used to launch rocket ships into outer space, and the proliferation of computers, even in the poorest school districts, you would think... You'd be wrong, but you'd think that the masses should be far more intelligent and informed than previous generations. Trouble is, nothing could be further from the truth. And he's right. And that's the focus of the article. The author goes on to talk about, and to some extent, to blame technology for the problem. As a former engineer, yeah, I have a certain love for technology. I spent most of my career getting paid to design some pretty neat things and things that I thought were doing real good. Mostly in my case, it was storage devices to store and retrieve data, but a lot of other things as well. So I don't see the problem with just technology, but kind of like a firearm, folks, it can be used either for good or evil. Same thing goes with just about any power tool or anything that anybody has built. There are people who will use it for building and creating, and others that choose to try to destroy, to take life. Here's what the author of this piece says. Technology is wasted, though, on people who haven't been taught to think critically, and they've been indoctrinated by government-run schools to be subservient cogs in a machine, and they believe feelings and emotions are more important than knowledge and understanding. Now, I'll go one step further, and I've suggested this for quite a while. I don't think people are taught not to think critically. I think they're taught not to think at all. And, in fact, they're taught to emote and feel rather than to actually use the brains that God gave them. The proliferation, the author continues, of social media, socialist media, Twitter, to Facebook, Instagram, and, of course, Gulag, has resulted in the dumbing down of human interactions and the replacement of discussing issues with, what now passes for discourse. Virtue signaling, selfies, manufactured faux outrage, and glorifying shallow celebrities. Yes, he says, we're addicted to technology. And this is kind of an interesting observation. By the way, he has a nice picture in here that really I thought was kind of stunning. You can't see it, of course, since we're doing radio. But it's a family that's clearly out in the woods somewhere camping. And who knows what mom and dad are doing. But meanwhile, the kids are sitting around a large, big screen TV with some kind of a game console in front of it. And they're playing video games out there in the wonderful creation of God while they're camping. That speaks volumes. It's incomprehensible, adds the author, that our society has embraced technology for all kinds of things, amusement, trivialities, and superficial displays of diversion, rather than the things that people once thought were its real promises. The advancement of knowledge, proliferation of ideas, and cultural progress and enrichment. The works of Aristotle, Socrates, Shakespeare, Dickens, Twain, Tolstoy, Steinbeck, Orwell, and Huxley. And I'll note the Bible, too. They're all available with one click of your iGadget. But instead, the masses choose to play Angry Birds, Candy Crush, and Madden while worshiping at the altar of Kardashian. So much wisdom and knowledge literally at our fingertips, and yet the average person, or 99.9% of them anyway, choose to amuse themselves into a stupor of ignorance. So, here comes the big question. Was this some kind of a conspiracy? What's really going on here? Is this infantile, infinite idiocy being designed and implemented by those controlling the culture through their ownership of the socialist media platforms? You can't argue that it appears to be a purposeful, deliberate strategy implemented by the ruling class to dumb down the masses through the public cesspool indoctrination systems, divert their attention and thoughts through modern-day electronic bread and circuses, enslaving them in debt, and then pillaging global wealth and power through control of all of the political, financial, and mass media structures. And now they use this same technology to spy on you and to make sure, whatever you do, you're not contradicting the establishment narrative. What we've got is a ceaseless mantra, he continues, that the government, megacorporations, Wall Street, banksters, and their chosen experts know what is best for us. Evidently, they don't want a citizenry who understands what's going on or knows how to think critically and question the establishment or even live within their means. They want obedient consumers, at least for now, who will march willingly to the gulags and believe what they're told by the authorities, the gatekeepers, and yes, the fact-checkers. The point is they need to be just smart enough to follow the rules laid down by their superiors and not one IQ point smarter. A nation built on illusions, delusions, disinformation, and confusion, and literally ripe for the destruction that's at hand, your host suggests, is what we've got. One more comment from Neil Postman in his book as we start to head to the bottom of the hour here. Television, he says, is, now remember, again, this is from about 1985. Television is altering the meaning of being informed by creating a species of information that might properly, and certainly it has been since, be called disinformation. Now, disinformation doesn't mean false information, although we got that now too. It means misleading information. This is back to what your host has referred to as the 80-20 rule for many years at this point. Misplaced, irrelevant, fragmented, or superficial information. Information that creates the illusion of knowing something, but in fact leads one away from actual knowledge. Note that you've got these big social media behemoths who can decide now what is acceptable speech and that which doesn't conform to their left-wing views. And as a result, we get censorship, public shaming, manufactured outrage, and destroying any of those who wish to share an alternative point of view. And the result is a control by a cabal of extremely wealthy men, who, by the way, are in cahoots with those who print the fake money, too. Now, back to Aldous Huxley versus 1984. In the end, he writes, Huxley, Brave New World, was trying to tell us that what afflicted the people in that book was not that they were laughing instead of thinking, but that they didn't know what they were laughing about and that they completely stopped thinking. Now, again, this book was published in 1985, 1 year after the title of Orwell's chilling dystopian novel of a brutal and dark future was supposed to have happened, but, well, didn't, at least not yet. Postman's view at the time was that Huxley's Brave New World dystopia was more accurate, at least then, than what we've seen since. And he was probably right for, about 3.5 decades. He assessed how the masses had been trained like Pavlov's dogs to follow their emotions rather than their intellects. So when we get back, what we're going to talk about are the two competing dystopian visions, what that means for today, and of course, as always, what can we do about it? half of the Come Out of Her My People show, and today's topic is Let's Talk Treason. I started out by outlining some of the definitions and indicating that, given that we no longer know what a fascist is or what, for crying out loud, the Constitution is, or what shall not be infringed means, or no warrant shall issue, or any number of things that once were prohibited by the supreme law of the land and now seem to be happening on a daily basis, well, treason doesn't seem to mean what it used to either because, well, those that took an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution have been literally gang-raping it for so long there are hardly any shreds of it left. So is treason, well, does that consist in making war against those who've already made war, probably successfully, against the government we were once supposed to have, or the other way around? Yeah, it's getting kind of tough to tell. And so far as the act of actually making war is concerned, I'll say it again. How many people have to die in order for the American people to realize, well, the war has been in progress for a long time? I guess what we're saying is, well, most Americans won't wake up to it until there are piles of body bags, and as long as they can keep those off the streets, they probably will just stay there watching their iPads and texting one another and saying, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. All right, as we went to break, I was talking about a really interesting article that makes a good point, I think, about technology, but more importantly, the competing visions of the two dystopian authors that wrote probably the two most well-known books on the topic of the last century or two, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, and George Orwell. Several books, but 1984 is the one we're talking about here. And the author, Neil Postman, that wrote a book back in 1985, made this point right at the outset of his book. Quote, "We were keeping our eye on 1984. When that year came and the prophecy didn't, thoughtful Americans sang softly in praise of themselves because the roots of liberal democracy had held. Whatever else the terror might have happened, well, at least we hadn't been visited, yet, I note, by Orwellian nightmares. But we'd forgotten that alongside Orwell's dark vision, there was another, slightly older, slightly less well-known, but equally chilling, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Now, contrary to common belief, even among the educated then, Huxley and Orwell did not prophesy the same thing. Orwell warns that we will be overcome by an externally imposed oppression. But in Huxley's vision, no big brother is required to deprive people of their autonomy, maturity, and history. As he saw it, people will come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo or undid their capacities to think." Now here I note probably one of the most chilling four words that ever closed out a book. It's from 1984. Now, if you haven't read the book, you should read it anyway, but I'm going to do the spoiler ending. He loved Big Brother. I remember the first time I read that, it literally sent a chill down my spine. Still does when I think about it. But, of course, Aldous Huxley and George Orwell are both making the same point. Whether it's fear or love, or at least pleasure, the end is the same. You've got two dystopian novels, both prophesying a future where people love their oppression and love Big Brother, arguably for different reasons. Now, this is an interesting set of comparisons. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book because there wouldn't be anybody who wanted to read one. Does that sound like an appropriate observation? Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. He's thinking of a two-faced book and gulag. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. You see what I'm trying to conclude? By the way, the author is headed in the same direction, obviously. We have now gotten to both. Orwell feared the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we'd become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy-porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy. Again, what we have, all of the above. As Huxley himself remarked in the book Brave New World Revisited, the civil libertarians and rationalists who were ever on the alert to oppose tyranny, quote, failed to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, Orwell added, people are controlled by inflicting pain, whereas in Brave New World, they're controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we fear will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we desire will ruin us. Now, Postman concludes, the book that he wrote is about the possibility that it was Huxley, not Orwell, who was right. Again, I suggest they both were, and we are now seeing both. And if you're curious, since you if you missed it, the book by Neil Postman was called Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. Now, a lot has changed since the book was written in 1985. Orwell's dark future then hadn't yet materialized, but Huxley's subtler dystopia required far fewer authoritarian measures. And what we got, of course, are people like Edward Bernays and his sycophants, the idea of propaganda, and, of course, the Nazis, too. That's far more effective in molding minds, designing the culture, and forming the ideas of the masses without them realizing what's going on, that they're nothing more than lab rats. Propaganda works. We've come to love our oppression, says the author of this piece, and our learned ignorance, adoring the very technologies that are enslaving us in trivialities, disinfo, shallow displays of virtue signaling, and so forth and so on. Yeah, people don't want to think critically. They don't want to question the status quo. And guess what? That's exactly what their masters want them not to do, to think critically, or to ignore their dictates, or to discuss real issues, things that are truly confronting the country, or generating ideas which might undermine their control and potentially reduce their vast riches and ability to kill anybody that they want, get away with it, and enjoy the process. I will suggest that this is the essence of what Scripture is about, what it warns us against, and what Come Out of Her, My People is about, discussing the real issues and our real alternatives. Now, the author goes on to say, well, Portman may have even been a bit naive in thinking that all of this was an accident. On this score, the author of this piece the Burning Platform and the author, your host anyway, are right on the same page. I don't believe it was an accident for a second. Even if you can't prove the conspiracy, Scripture indicates, just look and see the concept that's outlined in the very name, Ha-Shatan, the adversary. It's the adversary to what is described as good and right and truth, and ultimately the creator of the universe and his word. The adversary's been there all along. The battle has been there all along. All right, well, you get the point, I think. The tyranny being inflicted upon our masses, says the author here, by the likes of Gulag and Twitter and Two Facebook and Amazon and other tech behemoths, by the deep state and their public-private partners, is downright chilling in its depth and its depravity. The current-day Big Brothers ban truth-tellers. They commit censorship. They demonetize those who won't conform, and they publicly shame dissenters. All of that has replaced the soft tyranny of the Huxleyan-style mental manipulations. Now they openly suppress the truth. So, yeah, this is more like what Orwell was talking about. Dissenting viewpoints, he notes, are now being crushed through economic penalties first. You've also heard the term lawfare, I hope. You simply destroy people. Alex Jones is a primary example. By suing them and suing them and suing them with trivial stuff. Even if you win, you end up still being bankrupted and distracted from doing what they don't want you to do. This has been standard practice for a long time. And furthermore, when the FBI raids Alex Jones, and after you saw what Roger Stone was subjected to, I don't think they don't have something similar planned for Alex Jones and literally everybody else, too. But he calls himself the tip of the spear that might dare to threaten their technological information monopoly. Now, the problem is trying to lock down the Internet has proven to be difficult for the ruling class because at least a, well, let's call them a remnant of critically thinking, this guy says PO'd, that stands for peeved off citizens, are congregating on truth-telling websites and stirring discontent among the awakening masses. Yeah, President Trump was a lightning rod, at least for a while, for that disconsent. And the problem was, as the author says, and I concur again, Portman was just early. Huxwell and Orwell were both right. I'm going to read just one more quote. Now, this actually comes from Orwell, and it comes from the same book, and it really resonates, given all of this. This is the big brother representative, the antagonist in the story, talking to the guy who is the protagonist, Wilson, if I'm remembering right. He says, I'll tell you the answer. The party, meaning the party that Orwell described, the party seeks power entirely for its own sake. We're not interested in the good of others. We're interested solely in power, pure power. We know that no one ever seizes power with the intention of relinquishing it. Power is not a means, it is an end. One does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. The object of persecution is persecution. The object of torture is torture. The object of power is power. And now you begin to understand me. And folks, Orwell nailed it. Now, Aldous Huxley says this. One believes things because one has been conditioned to believe them. Most men and women will grow up to love their servitude and will never dream of revolution. Unquote. You may have heard me quote a line that, unfortunately, I've never been able to completely attribute. I won't claim that I authored it, but I certainly have used it for quite a while, and it goes like this. Let those who falsely believe they are free rattle their chains. All of that describes what I refer to now as America with a K. All right, let's talk in the last quarter of the show here about what all of this means and what we can do about it and ought to do about it. I'm going to drop a couple of possibilities as we think about, well, let's talk treason today. Starting with this, just two stories from the last 24 hours. James Inhofe of Oklahoma, senator and the head of the Armed Services Committee, warns that the U.S. and China are, quote, headed for World War III. I got story after story, this is nothing new, about China and Russia preparing for blackout warfare with super EMP bombs. And that, of course, is to some extent old news. Let me stop there and introduce kind of the concept that I want to lay out as we think about, again, what all of this means and what we can do. I'm going to divide the big lies, whether we're talking Orwell or Huxley, that we've been subjected to into two different primary categories. Okay, go with me and see if this makes sense and might help to clarify our thinking patterns. There are big lies that we can deal with, well, kind of anyway, once we see through them. Things that aren't true, we've been fed, and once we understand why and what we've been fed and why it's a lie, we can try to do something about it. Probably the foremost example is non-existent man-made global warming. The goal is to convince you to be afraid, be very afraid, go out and buy a bikini and not worry about the coldest winter we've seen in quite a while. And the fact that anybody that can look at solar cycles will tell you the colder winters and shorter growing seasons are just beginning. So global cooling is something we can and should be aware of and preparing for. For example, you can stockpile food against the famines that will result when growing seasons simply don't produce enough food. And this was exactly what's happened in the last several 200-year cycles that we've seen. Even though the data has been obscured, and I guarantee you're not going to hear the WAPO or CNN talk about this. But yeah, we can prepare for that. You can stockpile food. You can build a greenhouse. No matter where you live, it'll extend the growing season. Might even help with some of the other things in the lies we can deal with category. Okay, let's mention that other one. How about geoengineering? How about chemtrails? Uh-oh, you're not even allowed to say that. That's politically incorrect. Haven't we been fed the disinformation? You're a conspiracy theorist if you think that the crap being spewed out of airplanes that doesn't look like any kind of a contrail that those of us who are well-educated enough to know what a real contrail looks like, a condensation trail, they don't hang around for hours and they only form under certain conditions having to do with, amount of water in the atmosphere and temperature. Good grief. One of the things that a greenhouse will help do, in other words, is prevent the crap that they're spewing out from getting in whatever it is you're trying to grow. Now, that doesn't mean that it isn't going to contaminate the water table, so that's why I say there are big lies we can deal with, kinda, because ultimately there comes a point at which we realize, no, we have to fully rely on the Creator, on Yahuwah, because left to our own devices, we really can't survive what is clearly intended. How about this one? How about the one I've already just mentioned? The possibility, indeed the increasing likelihood, of an EMP. Or, perhaps even more likely, but you're not going to get told this, a cyber attack. Now, I've suggested for quite a while, one of the big issues with EMP is, will it or will it not take out people that are off-grid with, solar panels on the roof? Now, if you're connected to the grid, the EMP gets conducted in through the house wiring, probably burns down the house, so maybe you don't have to worry about whether there's panels on the roof or not. But ultimately, the issue is this. People who are truly off-grid, who don't have the power wiring coming in and don't have to worry about conducted massive pulses burning things down, still have to worry about how big is the EMP. In other words, if, in fact, it's a Chinese or Russian super weapon that is intended to take out everything, up to and including even some military fortified installations for command and control and so forth, well, that's a big problem. On the other hand, if the Chinese or the Russians intend to occupy what's left of America, maybe they'd like to keep the infrastructure intact. So a cyber attack, especially since they probably have the keys to the back doors, whether it's because Microsoft and Gulag and all the others are working for both teams and have given them the backdoor passwords, or whether they've just engineered them to be so easy to break into that any decent terror state ought to be able to accomplish it, doesn't matter. My point is, if there is a power grid failure, as we know, 90% of Americans will be dead within a year, and most Americans will believe what they're told. No, they're not going to tell you that. It was an EMP, they'll say. How do you know? If you don't know what an EMP even is or how the power grid works and all you know is that the power is off, air conditioning doesn't work, can't run the furnace, the trucks aren't delivering fuel, can't charge anything on my credit cards, can't use my bitcoins even because all of that's down along with the internet and the cell phones, ooh, we're in a whole world of hurt here. Does it matter if it was a cyber attack or an EMP? Well, it might. If your car runs, that gives you some kind of a clue. If your cell phone powers on but can't talk to anybody because the things that are connected to the cell phone towers are all down, that gives you another clue. But those of us who are completely off-grid will probably have a stronger clue as well. And the key is there are some things we can do about this one, too. You can put equipment that you'd like to have working after the EMP in a Faraday cage. And briefly, if you just get a good galvanized trash can with a nice sealing lid, put things in there that you want to keep, odds are they will survive most EMPs. They'll certainly survive the cyber attacks because there's nothing for them to talk to. The key, of course, for a Faraday cage is needs to be a fully conductive, literally 100% enclosed, no holes, kind of a shield. And the better the connection and the more conductive, the closer to a sphere, the better it's grounded and all that kind of stuff, the better. But in fact, a good galvanized trash can ought to work pretty well, and it certainly beats the alternative, which is not having anything. There are some other things we can, in fact, deal with if we recognize the lie. The big one that I've done whole shows on recently is, of course, 5G. Literally one of the most satanically evil things ever to be unleashed on people. I've got another article here about it. Key thing to know is that there is an intent to launch satellites into low Earth orbit as well. 20,000 of them are planned. With beam-forming technology, literally to zap these millimeter wavelengths things down anywhere in the world. The idea, of course, is that'll make it a lot more difficult to escape. Although, if you just simply get rid of any 5G devices that might attract the beams, you're ahead on that score, too. So I put it in the category of things that we can deal with, especially if you know it's coming. For crying out loud, don't buy one of these things, a real 5G. Don't allow it to be put anywhere near you. And the FCC has already said municipalities are not, get this, not going to be able to say no to this abomination because of mere concerns about people dying or not being able to sleep. No, it's only because of aesthetics that municipalities will be able to regulate it. It looks ugly, so maybe you have something to say about it, but if it kills your kid or your dog, live with it. Lump it. Either that or get the heck out of Dodge, folks. Get to a place where you do have more control, maybe a bigger piece of property where nothing that you don't want will be within 500 feet or so of you, which is the range of these devices unless they are beamed down from satellites. Well, there are obviously big lies that we can't, at least not on our own, really deal with. How about a bioengineered weaponry, global thermonuclear war, The chemtrail destruction that I mentioned kind of falls into the camp. We can't necessarily stop Big Brother from telling us that it's for our own good, that even though there's global cooling coming, he wants to put crap into the upper atmosphere to reflect more sunlight. How's that for not just stupid, but evil? If in fact, and I believe they do, because it's pretty obvious, if in fact they know what's coming. Who in their right minds, unless they have a hidey hole all prepared and intend to destroy and kill everybody on the surface, would want to increase the reflectivity of the atmosphere and reflect more sunlight, making things colder, when we have in fact global cooling coming on to begin with? This is nasty stuff. All right, here's another one. Suppose they impeach, or if they can't do that, kill the president and finally get the civil war started that they have intended to. Lots and lots of possibilities, things that will be a lot more difficult for us to deal with. Oh, here's another one that's been in the news of late. You're seeing it in, New York, and now you've got a governor in Virginia saying we want to commit post-birth abortion. Especially, I think, if it's going to be to fix white privilege and get rid of white males that we don't want anymore. But they'll tell you they're not racist. Oh, don't kid you. And they'll tell you they're all for the children, except for when they want to kill the children. See, if you've been dumbed down enough, this kind of stuff doesn't even raise the hackles of those who say, what? Is there a contradiction here? All right, the point is the following, as we think about wrapping all this up. It's the deception. It's the fact that we don't recognize it because we've been taught not to think. Not just not to think critically, but not to think at all. So it's the deception that kills. You expect that it's going to be warmer, so you don't prepare. The thing that kills you is freezing or starving to death. In almost every case of the things that I've talked about here, big lies that we can deal with and ought to understand, and in fact, even a lot of the big lies that we can't deal with, the big city, given what's coming, is a death trap. So, obviously, while you can and time draws short, get the hell out of the hell holes, or the S-holes, as the president properly described some of these things. Look at San Francisco, strewn with needles and feces. Denver is trying to do likewise. Other municipalities, for reasons that only can be described as either satanic or self-destructive, are all trying to say, yeah, whatever it is that we're doing, it's intended to kill a whole lot of folks. When the power grid goes down, folks, and the roads turn into congealed jelly, as the stoplights don't work, and you can't buy gas anyway, and the highwaymen block the roads, if not the military, the cities become a death trap. You've heard the old saying that 9 meals, 72 hours, is all that separates a society from total breakdown and literally cannibalism. When the power grid goes down within 3 days, yeah, there'll be rape, roving gangs, and cannibalism within the big city death traps. Bottom line in all of these things is learn to think. Teach your children to use the brains that God gave us. Think critically. Do question the lies that we're being told. And above all, take responsibility. Yes, most of this battle is, in fact, a spiritual battle. It is a spiritual destruction that is being reaped and wreaked on purpose. I mentioned that line, and I like that line. Spiritual devastation is what is going on, and it's intended. And it's going to be manifest physically, economically, and in so many other ways. Oh, yes, the economic meltdown, that's another one that is something we can deal with. And the biblical answer is the same as it's always been. Real money is kesef, silver. Constitutional money is silver. And the law still exists, actually, says that gold and silver coin are still lawful coinage in the United States. Yep, you can still use those things, and you better get them while you still can, although it's getting tougher. Again, it's the deception that kills, whether we're talking about economics or things that will kill people physically. Some of the other things just take a little while longer. But ultimately, the solution is the same. We must, in fact, take responsibility for ourselves and for our families and our loved ones. We can even take responsibility for helping to try, at least, if they don't listen, they don't listen, but their blood is on their own heads, but try to inform others about what's coming. A few more will listen as it gets more and more obvious, and by that time it may well be too late. As for the rest of us, though, the big deal is what we can do, and perhaps most importantly, it is vital in these days that we know who we should trust and who we serve.
and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.